Welcome to Modular March. I'm Andy, this is Robbie, and we are The Roll-Up.
Modular March is an educational experience about all things modular. Enjoy.
Welcome back to Modular March. Today we have a presentation from Josh Bowen from Astria about the shared sequencer network that they're building, amongst other cool topics in the modular space. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Pleasure. Let's dive right in.
Yeah, okay, let's just jump right into the presentation. So as you said, I'm Josh. I'm the founder over at Astria. We're building the shared sequencer network. And, you know, I know you guys have already had some presentations on kind of shared sequencers and a lot of the different components of the modular stack. So I'm going to try to present, you know, really briefly kind of like why we're building a shared sequencer network, what we view that to mean, not just in, I'd say, like a specific kind of technical, you know, implementation detail of like, you know, what it's built up on. You know, happy to touch on details there, but I think NodeKit already gave some kind of good context there, but generally kind of why we built a shared sequencer really is this kind of idea of we think it's important that people can deploy a decentralized rollup as easily as a smart contract. So a lot of kind of how we've thought about, you know, the business and the product justification for building a shared sequencer came out of this motivation to say, like, all right, if we, you know, the origin kind of came out of my time at Celestia as like an early employee there and kind of saying, okay, there's this new abundant block space. We want rollups to be able to take advantage of that. How do we think we're going to do that? And the things that came out of that is like, you know, for kind of like scaling reasons, you know, these data layers, you know, they scale better with like larger, slower blocks just due to some kind of like technical details there. But as we saw with kind of, you know, the discussion around like based rollups that's kind of been revived, but, you know, the original rollups were based rollups, but users end up preferring these kind of faster user experience. And that's why sequencers generally kind of came about. And so we kind of accept the thesis of, you know, we have new block space. We think that's going to be used by, you know, rollups, and we think those rollups are going to run, you know, sequencers. And generally we view it as important that these sequencers are decentralized, you know? And so then the big thing is, what is the tooling necessary beyond, you know, the Celestia base layer itself to make this accessible and usable by these rollups? And again, coming back to this, like deploy a decentralized rollup as easily as a smart contract, because a lot of our view is, if we're going to see, you know, 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or whatever, pick your number of rollups, our view is that, you know, it's not like every single rollup that is like built or deployed is going to find product market fit. And so if you want to have 10,000 of these, you might have to deploy 100,000 or 1,000,000 of these to find the 10,000 that actually have some amount of product market fit. And that means you have to reduce the barrier to entry for developers to be able to build these things. You know, what we need to move away from is, you know, a lot of the great work that, you know, the kind of flagship rollups, you know, your Arbitrums, your Optimism, your ZK Sync, your Scroll, you know, et cetera, they spent, you know, multiple years and raised multiple rounds to kind of build this, you know, foundational technology. But if you want to have like 100 of these or 1,000, again, you can't have the barrier to entry be spending 3 years of R&D and building a 100-person team. We need to make this something that's really accessible to like a broader audience so that we can weed out the ones that don't work and find the kind of like survivors that remain that are actually kind of providing value to this overall ecosystem. And so at some level, you know, I think it is useful as a thought experiment to think of a shared sequencer as a decentralized cloud. And some of the big things that, you know, we think are kind of, you know, they might sound minor, but we think are like extremely core to like the kind of the mindset we kind of take when building the shared sequencer from, again, a technical perspective, but also from like the product experience that people use going back to this deploying as easily as a smart contract, is the permissionless nature of using the shared sequencer. So, you know, a shared sequencer is a form of like shared security, and that you have multiple rollups that are all kind of using the single kind of, you know, sequencer network that is essentially just like a new L1 coming to consensus over an ordered set of blocks where those blocks contain transactions from multiple rollups. In that design, we think it's very important that there's no requirement to kind of do a registration or governance process to kind of use the shared sequencer. I think we've seen historically in the other kind of primary shared security designs, notably, right, like Cosmos with their interchain security now called replicated security, and Polkadot with their parachain. You know, Polkadot had these parachain auctions. And what we saw in the dynamics of that was that if you were a project that wanted to kind of be a parachain, you needed to go kind of recruit through the market a very, very significant amount of capital, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases, to win a parachain auction for the right to be one of these relatively small number of parachains that could be allowed. And then in the Cosmos land, you know, to be like a replicated security chain, of which we have like Neutron and Stride, right? You know, you needed to kind of win a governance fight kind of with the Atom kind of like token holders. And our view is that, you know, what we don't want to do is take this kind of like relatively well-known, you know, business and technical challenge of establishing your own validator set to run a sovereign chain and convert that into this kind of BD and governance problem of saying, well, okay, I don't need to go get my own validators. I don't need to kind of stand up that network, but I need to convince an existing set of validators to give me permission to kind of bless my new chain. And maybe that's a reduction in absolute effort, but it's still kind of like non-trivial and is going to lead to a relatively small number of chains that are going to kind of like be willing or able to kind of experiment in this space. Whereas if you compare it to kind of like deploying a smart contract on like Ethereum L1 or one of the existing L2s, right? You know, no one has to ask. You just need to have some funds to kind of submit your transaction to like, you know, deploy your contract onto the chain. And that's all there is to it. You don't have to talk to anyone, right? It's very permissionless. And so that's something that we think about a lot in the kind of shared sequencer on a technical level that leads into kind of the product experience that's available here. You know, again, similar to this kind of cloud versus say like, you know, co-location kind of like history. If you wanted to deploy a server, you know, you can go to a colo facility. It's not that hard. You know, you buy a rack, you buy that from a supplier, Dell or whoever, right? And then you go talk to your colo facility and deploy that. But it's relative to the effort of I go have, you know, an account I set up with OAuth on AWS or Azure or GCP, and I click a button and I have a server. That gap in effort is like dramatically larger. And we think we see a lot of these kind of like longer tail projects that are able to kind of like, you know, get their feet wet and see if what they have is some idea that they're willing to like lean into prior to raising kind of all of this capital up front to kind of try this larger effort. So that's one of the big kind of theses that we over at Astria kind of think is like core to what we're building. And kind of touching really briefly on just like, you know, what is a sequencer at like a very, very high level? And we can kind of skip through this quickly. You know, fundamentally, our view is that, you know, rollups or blockchains generally are in this space of like this transaction order flow. And there's this like transformation of kind of like information, right? You have these users submitting these unordered transactions, and the role of the sequencer is to create an ordered block. And then the role in our view of like this rollup full node in this like execution layer is to execute the block. And then, you know, it's like strictly optional, but in the kind of rollup landscape, you know, we see people generating these succinct proofs of these blocks. And so this is just like a high level thesis. We can come back as like a reference if useful. Again, touching on a very, very high level of kind of like where shared sequencers and like decentralized sequencers kind of fall in the stack. There's this kind of matrix here of like, you know, in the top left, you have a centralized independent sequencer. And this is the state of most rollups today, right? Your Arbitrum and your Optimism. They're running one sequencer. It is owned, maintained, whatever, by the foundation of the labs or whatever. And they are only sequencing their own chain. You know, and we're looking much more in this kind of bottom right category where you have, you know, a set of sequencers, right? And each of those decentralized sequencers is doing the job of sequencing, again, going back to the transaction order flow for multiple rollups. Again, this is a very, very high level kind of like picture of like how we see this, right? A user is going to submit a transaction to this consensus set of rollup sequencers who are going to give a soft commitment. And then we're assumed that the sequencer is going to batch these blocks, you know, of transactions to a data availability layer, which is going to give a hard commitment. So this is just kind of like, you know, high level kind of like slides that might be useful, you know, for like Q&A section to kind of use as like reference points. Again, kind of, you know, trying to go through this presentation relatively quickly so we can get some other things is, you know, this is to the kind of like permissionless thing. And one of the big things about this kind of like cloud thing, and a lot of my background is in kind of cloud land, is thinking about developer tooling and developer experience as like a core differentiation in you know, business to business kind of like software products. You know, fundamentally a shared sequencer is a piece of middleware. And so our customers are assumed to be software engineers, right? These are people who are developers. And so what we need to provide is a high quality developer experience that is, you know, again, harkening back to this kind of line about like, you know, as easily as deploying a smart contract, we are in the business of making it an easy user experience for people to kind of build things. And so this is kind of our component architecture. And the reason we've built it this way is fundamentally that we want to provide an out-of-the-box experience that gives someone that is maybe a less sophisticated kind of developer the capacity to get their foot in the door, but it is modular in its kind of like software architecture in a way that allows a more sophisticated user, whether they became sophisticated after using our product or they showed up kind of in a more sophisticated capacity, to customize something that is like a better fit for their specific needs. And so, you know, generally we're within like the Celestia ecosystem. And so what we see is on the right side, you know, we have Celestia, and that's kind of like not our business to kind of maintain. That's a separate network, but that's what we use for data availability. And we have the sequencer and its own relayer component. And these are somewhat tightly coupled. That is kind of, it's in a separate box because fundamentally this is something that we assume the end user, you know, our customer is not responsible for. You know, they're not assumed to be like a validator or a sequencer kind of participant in the shared sequencer network. They're just kind of consuming this as a product for them. And so this is, this whole right side of this kind of diagram is assumed to be something that the customer of Astrea is outsourcing. And then this roll-up side is very much where we see our users kind of working. You know, this roll-up box, you know, and the easy example would be like, this is essentially just like a guest node, right? This is your roll-up state machine. This could also be like a Cosmos SDK application. And we provide, you know, these blue boxes are like components that like Astrea develops and like, you know, owns, is fundamentally sidecar components and pieces of software. And a lot of this is taken from kind of like modern cloud microservice architectures in that we want users to be able to integrate a roll-up kind of their choosing, whether it's a guest node, whether it's a Cosmos SDK application, whether it's something from like Sovereign Labs with the Sovereign SDK, or something kind of like, you know, truly novel, to be able to integrate with the sequencer very easily in kind of a robust fashion. So we provide this composer as a sidecar component. And what it does is it's just responsible for kind of essentially acting as a gas station right now for abstracting the transaction submission flow between a rollup and the sequencer. And this is very useful because it provides a very well-defined interface and an out-of-the-box component that's like a, you know, permissively licensed MIT Apache 2 dual license kind of piece of code that runs in our net, you know, not in our network. It runs, you know, as like a sidecar to the users, you know, developers, customers, whatever kind of stuff. And we invite developers to modify this. Essentially what we're saying is like, you can get started with this battery included model. And then if you want to change how you're interacting, here is a template of like permissively licensed code that allows you to customize it such that, you know, you may have specific use cases, but we borrow a lot of the lessons from what we saw, I think, in the MEV design space around kind of like post merge with like MevBoost. You know, we saw these kind of like builders and these relays coming about. And when the merge first happened, Flashbots was kind of the primary entity running a builder. And they were signaling very strongly to the kind of like broader Ethereum community saying like, look, we're aware that like we are like a centralized point of failure within like block building right now. We highly encourage everyone to create competitive builders. We have defined these APIs. Like, please kind of like come and build your own software and like compete with us and like reduce the kind of percent of the market we have. But the reality, you know, of the situation was it was too large of a hurdle for a lot of these developers to get over to bootstrap one of these builders kind of like themselves. There was just like the initial effort to kind of get their foot in the door was too much. And so the reality is we really saw a kind of builder percentage kind of drop away from Flashbots when they provided their own builder software as like an open source MIT license component. And a lot of people could just copy and paste it and redeploy it on their server and compete directly and then start to make modifications. And so that's a lot of the inspiration for kind of like why we've provided the composer here is, if we want people to be able to modify this, you need to provide them a starting point that works out of the box, that's flexible enough that they can modify it later. But the bootstrapping requirement of them having to kind of, you know, genesis an entirely new component kind of like with no template was kind of too much. And then this conductor is another thing. This is kind of, again, we want to provide this like single kind of clean interface for how rollups, you know, again, of whatever state machine, you know, whether it's the state machines that are kind of dominant right now, you know, generally in the kind of ETH space or the existing rollup, you know, or kind of like blockchain frameworks like Cosmos SDK or something in the future. We're going to provide a single well-defined, you know, API And this conductor also runs the sidecar component to this rollup. And so I can touch on that in more detail, but you know, I'll just kind of move forward here. And again, this kind of like transaction flow, right? This is, you know, again, like more of like a useful kind of reference document. We have more words in our blogs and whatever, but this is how we see the kind of flow of the kind of shared sequencer working here, right? Where a user of a given rollup, right? So this is like a retail user or whatever, is actually interacting with the rollup node. And this composer component is again provided as this like out of the box abstraction layer between any given rollup node and our sequencer. The relayer is something, again, the sequencer and relayer box are kind of like within the scope of like Astria. It's not a thing that we assume our kind of like rollup developers are going to use. And then this conductor is provided, again, as this kind of out of the box component that's responsible for retrieving blocks both from the sequencer as well as from the data availability layer and providing these filtered blocks to the rollup node. And so, you know, we provide this battery included kind of like platform that people can kind of develop and iterate upon. You know, just kind of like wrapping up, I think this is my last slide. Yeah, so the last slide, and this loops back to kind of the conductor and the composer. Fundamentally, our view on a kind of like rollup, like full node architecture, and this kind of idea of rollups as a derivation of a kind of ordered list of data that maybe we'll say low context, and that, you know, it's just bytes, it's a serialized stream of bytes. From the perspective of, say, the L1, the rollups data in like an Ethereum case may just be call data, or in like Celestia case, it's just like blob data. And like the L1 itself is intentionally kind of ignorant of the data and what that data might mean to another layer. And fundamentally, the work that a rollup full node is doing is running a derivation kind of function, right? A derivative function over this like subset of data that is stored on the L1. And it is processing that through an execution engine to generate this rollup block. And if we like look at all the other diagrams, these are all saying the same thing. But this is kind of our view. And this is kind of fundamentally what like the conductor is like enabling through like well-defined APIs. It's essentially responsible for saying, I'm going to go read the data off the shared sequencer, and that's going to give me my soft commitment. I'm going to go read the batch data off of the data availability layer, and that's going to give me my firm commitment. But it's going to provide a single well-defined API, this interface that we call an execution API, that's going to provide this list of rollup transactions that is specific to a given rollup node that's saying, you know, okay, we can have 100 rollups running against this shared sequencer in this DA layer. And you as rollup, you know, one might only want, you know, a given subset of those transactions in, you know, namespace one or whatever. And that list of rollup transactions is going to be provided to your rollup node via this well-defined engine API. And then you just do the execution of the rollup block. And so, sorry, the point I'm trying to get at here is like, a lot of kind of Astria as a project and how we think about ourselves in the broader kind of blockchain space is fundamentally, yes, we're building a shared sequencer. We are, you know, Astria itself is a shared sequencer network. But fundamentally, the problem we're trying to solve is to make it kind of easy for developers to be able to build rollups. And specifically, we're looking kind of farther out. We're not just trying to kind of satisfy existing developers who might be saying, oh, I'm going to go take, you know, the OP stack and I'm going to fork that and I'm going to go deploy that on like AWS, or I'm going to go take like a Polygon CDK and I'm going to fork that and I'm going to go deploy that on like GCP, or I'm going to go take an Arbitrum Orbit chain and maybe I actually do some modifications with Orbit, you know, using Stylus and have like at least a slightly different kind of state machine. And I'm going to go redeploy that. You know, we're interested in providing a well-defined but generalized interface such that we can see this low barrier to entry and innovation on the state machine so that the world of many rollups takes advantage of a lot of the properties provided by like a modular architecture that is not just saying, oh, we're just going to have like 500 different EVM nodes. That's fundamentally like an undifferentiated and to us an uninteresting future. If you just say, yeah, cool, I'm like the 75th L3 running on base using XYZ for data availability. It's like, great, but like, why would someone use that instead of the 74th L3 running on, you know, base or whatever, right? We think we need to provide a platform that lowers the barrier to entry for people to do interesting, novel, innovative things on the state machine. And that's a lot of kind of how we structure our project. So I know that was like a long thing. Like, I'll pause there. But that was kind of like just giving a high level view of like our vision at Astria and how we kind of approach this as like a business unit and where we see this over, you know, whether 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and kind of like what our motivation is kind of in this broader modular space.
Awesome. I love the vision. Before we get too deep into the technical details, I'm curious about the business logic. And especially because you mentioned, you brought up Flashbots, how they had a significant market share of the builder market, and how they open sourced their builder. And then they saw some of that market share dwindle as a result of people coming in, kind of forking their builder and then modifying it and optimizing it. And how you're aiming to almost replicate a similar trajectory for the shared sequencer. Like what's the business logic there? Behind open sourcing it and not just kind of like taking that market share and running with it.
Yeah. So I think a lot of it's a question of kind of like where you're kind of like capturing revenue, right? And like the almost like try it. I'm pretty exhausted by this question now. It's been asked of me like, you know, a couple dozen times over like the last 2.5 years. It's like, where does value accrue in the modular stack, right? It's just like low hanging fruit thing. This question has been asked like so many times, but like fundamentally you do have to think about like where in this stack am like I as like a project, as a protocol actually like capturing value. And so, you know, the things that we are providing, you know, all of our code is open source because I think it would be insane for like any of these people to say like, oh, I'm going to go use like, you know, like a non-custodial cryptocurrency network where like I don't have the ability to like look into the code. Like that's just like a good way to like lose all your funds. You know, whether or not these customers are like actually going to like review the code themselves, you know, you want to make sure that like someone can. But fundamentally, these components that we're providing is like an open source thing, right? And these things to be modified are fundamentally, you know, hearkening to this, you know, it's almost like kind of like right at this point, but like Joel Spolsky has a really, really good blog post that everyone references from like whatever, 2001, 2002. And he's a former early kind of person at like Microsoft who did like Excel, and he did a bunch of interesting things after that. But he had this post on kind of commoditize the complement. And what that means is like you are like somewhere in some like vertical stack of like software that is being developed. And so in his case, it was like, you know, he's like at Microsoft or like Excel or whatever. And so I'll start with like kind of their example. But like if you're Microsoft, right, you're in the business of selling primarily we'll say like operating systems right on top of computers. And what was very valuable to Microsoft is saying they want to commoditize the complement. So to have someone be able to buy an operating system, it implies that they have to have already purchased like a computer, like a desktop. So it is beneficial for Microsoft to reduce the barrier to entry for people to acquire computers, right? If computers are cheaper, they have a larger customer base from which they can sell operating systems into, right? So it is beneficial for them to commoditize the act of kind of being a computer. And what we really saw, you know, this is a little bit like old hat, but like, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, right? We saw this very large kind of divide between, you know, a PC and a Mac. And you saw this very aggressive marketing campaign from you know, Apple to say like, we are like a Mac, we're not a PC, right? They very much did not want to be commoditized because they knew that they are in the business of making money by selling computers, right? And to this day, right, like they sell very expensive kind of premium, relatively high margin as hardware goes, kind of computers. And it was important for them to not be commoditized. But from Microsoft's perspective, they're like, look, maybe I have a licensing agreement, whatever, but like, I don't really care if people are buying like a computer that is like $2,000 or like $1,000. I just want them to buy a computer that they are then going to buy like a Microsoft thing. And so from Astria's view, like we are in the business of running a shared sequencer network. To use the shared sequencer network, you have to submit transactions into it. And it has like an implied cost, right? It's a decentralized network. You need like your DOS prevention. It costs money to like submit a transaction to like use the resources that network is providing. What we want to do is we want to commoditize the all of the kind of components that are necessary to use the shared sequencer network, right? And by and large, there's going to be like roll-up frameworks. And to some degree, and I'll touch on this a little more, is like, you know, roll-up as a service things, right? Fundamentally, these components required for a developer to start using the shared sequencer network, we want to drive the cost of those as close to zero as possible, because that's not where we're capturing value, right? I am not trying to like have a differentiated value by creating the best roll-up framework from like a Polygon CDK or an Orb or an OP stack. What I want is that all of those things are easily available to users to build on top of our shared sequencer platform, and that there is not a lot of like rent capture, right? So, you know, there's been this like meme that I think it was like the Bankless guys that put around, right? It's like the Spider-Man, everyone shooting each other meme, whatever. Like, and it was like, oh, the roll-up of the service and the shared sequencers and the roll-up frameworks all kind of competing with each other, right? And to some degree, yes, right? All of these people are trying to say, okay, we have a stack and you need all of these components in the stack to create one kind of working product that a retail end user might interact with. Which of these layers in the stack is actually going to be extracting the most value? And kind of a stance we have taken is we say, look, we are deciding that our middleware, our shared sequencer, that is where we are choosing to kind of capture value. We are the ones that are going to have a network that is going to like accrue revenue through that kind of part of the overall kind of transaction flow. And therefore, we want to make sure that no one is able to kind of gatekeep via kind of like charging a premium for either the rollup framework itself, right? And we've seen a lot of this, right, in the difference in adoption between, say, the OP stack and, like, the Arbitrum, like, Orbit stack, right? Like, fundamentally, right, like, there are some people now, right, and the Arbitrum people are going to be pissed at this, but, like, the reality is when Arbitrum came out, they said our stuff is BSL, right? It's like a business source license. And the general view of a lot of software engineers is not absolute, but, like, coming from my background, generally the view is I go to a repo and I see it's BSL or lacking a license and I just leave. I'm just like, I don't give a shit what's going on there. It might be interesting. It might be good code. It is not permissively licensed. It might as well not exist to me because it is just not worth my time to even investigate, right? I'm not going to go get into a conversation where I'm going to go ping my legal counsel and say, hey, can you review this BSL so that I can go have a discussion with, like, Packy over at the Arbitrum DAO to figure out what is their kind of ideological worldview that they feel is myself being a sufficient member of the Arbitrum ecosystem to have permission to use their code. I just say, ah, there's the Orbit chain happening over there. I don't care. That functionally doesn't exist. I'm going to go look at the OP stack because that is an MIT license code base and I can use that permissively and I can modify that how I want. I don't have to have a conversation with anyone to figure out if I'm going to be able to use that, right? And what we've seen is a lot more people are deploying OP stack chains than they are Orbit chains, right? And recently we saw the Arbitrum DAO kind of specify more explicitly, here is the default out of the box kind of like license agreement that you can have for using Arbitrum's code base, right? But fundamentally they kind of caved because no one was using their damn code. Because it doesn't matter if your code is good if everyone just says, ah, it's like too much effort for me to even consider, right? Like, I'm like a dev. I'm like one guy. I don't have a company. I'm not going to get fucking like a lawyer on the phone to decide whether I can use this GitHub repo or not, right? Just like not worth my time. I don't care if it's better or not. Just not worth my time, right? And so from our view, it's kind of important that we don't see kind of people say, oh, the only way I can build a rollup is via code that requires me to go get a business agreement that requires me to have lawyers in the mix. And therefore my starting point is a couple thousand dollars of legal fees before I even start, you know, building a prototype to decide if something's going to work. Right. And then going one step further, you know, Astri fundamentally, right, has done like a relatively poor job of kind of like marketing itself broadly about what exactly it is we're building, right? What is our kind of like viewpoint kind of like in this broader space? You know, and we've been a little confusing, right? We're building a shared sequence. We're building our own EVM. We're building our own rollup as a service. And why are we building all of these things? It's all in this vein of this commoditized accomplishment. We built our own rollup as a service because around, you know, mid last summer, right, there's a lot of hype, right? You have Caldera, you have Conduit, right? And the Gelato is pivoting into this. There's like 17 other goddamn rollup as a services, right? And like, what are we hearing from kind of people who are interested in building a rollup? Is one, they're kind of learning what is the kind of design space and capability of the rollup they can build from the rollup of the service providers, right? That's their entry point in the market. So the customer relation is starting at the rollup of the service providers. And then what we're also hearing is fundamentally, these rollup of the service providers are generally VC-funded entities that raised relatively good valuations, whether in the bull market or the bear market or whatever, right? And they have to return VC-style returns. And they're enterprise software, right? They're software selling to other software developers. The way you're going to want to structure your contracts is you don't want someone to rock up, click a button, and pay you a monthly fee with the option to cancel that subscription immediately. Your investors aren't going to want to see that. What they're going to want is you go to their website and you click a button and you schedule a call and you talk to the team and that team gets on and their sales guy is there. And if you want to use their stuff, you have a sales call and they're not going to try to get you on a monthly pay-as-you-go thing. They're going to try to lock you into a 12-month contract so that they can mark in their investor update next month that we have these many customers signed for 12 months and we can guarantee all that revenue. And again, this is another thing that is a gate-kept kind of like access to this. People think the way they build a rollup or deploy a rollup requires them to go with a rollup service provider. And when they talk to those people, they're going to say, well, I have partnerships with XYZ rollup framework. I'm going to be reselling those and you're going to have to commit to a 12-month thing. And then going one step further, right? You know, we had like 4844 like this last week, right? But prior to that, you're seeing this very, very high call data cost, right? 10 grand, 20 grand a month to post, you know, data to like Ethereum L1 call data. So now what you're seeing is you're a user and you say, I want to deploy an Arbitrum Orbit chain. I don't know how much I have to pay Arbitrum DAO. I'm going to have to get a conversation with them. I'm going to have to get lawyers. I'm going to go to roll up a service provider and they're going to say, I'm going to try to lock you in a 12-month thing. And the numbers we are hearing were ranging from $5,000 to $15,000 a month on a 12-month commitment. So call it 150 grand. And then they're going to say, I'm going to use, you know, OP stack or Arbitrum Orbit, whatever. And maybe it writes empty blocks as a call data. Regardless of usage, my floor cost of L1 call data is going to be $10,000 a month. And so now you're like, cool, I want to do a roll up. and I'm faced with a, whatever, call it $20,000 a month bill with a 12-month commitment before I've even like written any code, before I've deployed anything, and now I have kind of contractual relations that commit me to like a 12-month effort. You say, well, maybe I don't have like $500,000 in the bank. I'm not going to explore this option. So we built our own RAS because, again, we needed to commoditize this. We needed to understand what is the effort that is actually required to deploy one of these rollups in a way that uses our shared sequencer. And so we can understand from like a dog fooding perspective, right? What is the complexity to actually use our network? And then also we can say, look, what does it cost in cloud compute, right? Just naively, how much money does it cost to run a Geth node and a Block Scout instance and, you know, an indexer for that Block Scout? And how much bandwidth is that going to cost me? And how much storage is that going to cost me over what time frame? At, you know, even measure it at the standard retail no time commitment to like a cloud provider, and then understand what are the margins that we think these RAS providers are charging and how do we drive those margins down really, really aggressively. And, you know, we haven't kind of like doubled down on our RAS, and I can give a demo of it. You know, we have it in kind of like a private kind of like, you know, internally managed capacity. But the reality is because we just saw the market kind of take away a lot of this kind of gatekeeping ability to kind of like, you know, have the only one option, and these prices kind of came down very aggressively on their own. So we kind of developed this and we dog food and we understand a lot of the kind of metrics and the cost of these things. But, you know, we kind of realized that like, okay, based on where we're at right now, that's maybe not the best use of our time. But yeah, I know there's like a long-winded answer, but generally kind of like our view is this thing of like, we're making money on sequencing. I'm not making money on charging licensing fees on the rollup framework. That's someone else's job. And it's my job to make sure they're not getting as much money as possible for that so that my users have the cheapest kind of like initial buy-in cost. And therefore we can have the largest quantity of customers.
I like the business philosophy of showing a category, hey, it's not that hard what you're doing. Actually, it's this easy that we can do it. Look how easy it is. And then by showing someone how easy it is, you show they're not providing that much value and therefore drive their prices down. They can't charge that much if it's that easy to do what they do. And then the other point is like no argument from open sourcing software on my front. Big fan of open source in general. Andy?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we've talked about RAS being commoditized on the channel before. Josh, would you mind just pushing back a couple slides? I think to one of the first slides where you were talking about your design, I think right before this one maybe, or yeah, I think basically on the decentralized cloud kind of conversation, whether it's on the slide or not, and based on this, on your long-winded answer that you gave, one of the key things was like this removal of like basically BD, something that we're like getting really, really passionate about in the modular expansion. Like we can't have thousands of app chains or rollups or isolated execution environments and need interoperability providers to talk to every chain, every BD. We can't have RPCs needing to do like grants just to get on their chain. We can't have bridges, sequencers. Like all of this has to be like you say, out of the box. So the question that I have for you is like, how is Astria's solution that you're providing supposed to be that much different from the kind of antithesis of permissioned deployment of rollups and then eventual connection to shared sequencers?
Right. So I guess just like on like the permissions nature and like the gate kept nature, right? If like we want to say like who is like the primary gatekeepers, right? And like people are gonna get like mad, but I think quite frankly, like a lot of this industry is like unwilling to just like say the quiet part out loud thing that like everyone will discuss, right? Like who are like the primary gatekeepers in a lot of like the broader kind of crypto industry when it comes to new chains? It's gonna be, you have Chainlink and you have Layer Zero, right? And fundamentally, this is gonna be Chainlink is kind of the like dominant like Oracle feed, right? But like you think about like what an Oracle is, right? And like the green frogs are gonna get all mad on Twitter, but like fuck them, right? Fundamentally, right, what you're doing is you're going to go get some like price feeds from like Tower Research or like whatever the hell, right? Or like Amber Group. You're going to get these price feeds and you're going to aggregate them across like a set of nodes. You're going to run some averaging kind of mechanism, TWAP, whatever the hell, right? And you're just going to post a JSON blob or whatever the kind of structure is to like an Ethereum contract on chain. And you're going to talk to Chainlink and Chainlink's going to say, yeah, that's going to cost you $10 million a year, right? Like, why is it going to cost you $10 million a year? Well, because Chainlink has a token and Chainlink has a lot of employees and they pay their employees well and they want to be able to pay those salaries, right? But if you're like wanting to have like 100, 200, 500, 1,000 new kind of like rollup chains, and these things are going to be like by and large, right? Like I'm still of the view that like crypto is primarily like a financial thing, right? And so these people want to do like financial tasks. You know, generally the kind of like rough things we're doing in like finance, you're gonna have like a DEX, you know, you have like a spot DEX, an AMM, whatever. You have a lending pool, you have a perp, And a perp to some degree is just like an abstraction on having leverage on like a lending pool combined with like a DEX with like some different like kind of like technical mechanisms. And that lending protocol is going to be reliant on having like an external Oracle price feed so they can like run liquidations, right? And so you just can't have a, like a DeFi ecosystem bootstrapped unless you go get an Oracle. And the Oracle is going to say, yeah, we know that. And we're the dominant thing. And we're just going to charge a premium for that, right? And so, you know, you see that. And then, you know, on like bridging, right? And like liquidity, you know, one of the kind of trade-offs of like an AMM design, right? It's fundamentally AMMs are like just very, very bad from like a slippage per dollar of like TVL locked, right? Like relative to like a like an order book or whatever, right? They just like have like a bad ratio there. So you need to get a lot of liquidity. And so what you see is these bridge networks, right? Like Layer Zero being like the strongest example here, who are essentially saying, well, we're not just selling you the tech of doing like a mint lock escrow bridge, which is like not that technically complicated of a thing, right? You say like, oh, I have like a token and I'm gonna like lock in a contract here. And I'm gonna have like an Oracle that's going to like post like an attestation of a state root on like a different chain. That chain is gonna mint a derivative token on that. Maybe you have like a third leg that's gonna say, yeah, now when I have proof that like the derivative token is like minted or whatever, I go burn it back on like the origin chain. Like that technical design is not that complicated. It's been done like whatever, like 10-20 times now, but they're going to say, yeah, but you also get access to our liquidity network as like an out of the box thing. And that's actually what you're buying with like a partnership with like Layer Zero or whatever. Right. And they're going to try to restrain that access. Right. Because again, they want to make sure they're getting their cut. And so you have this thing where there's a lot of these technical fundamentals of saying, okay, I can go take open source code and I can deploy it on like one of N clouds. And it's just not that hard. There's a lot of like good kind of deployment tools. We've built a bunch ourselves. But fundamentally, if you actually want to get it into a space where it can be like a robust DeFi ecosystem, you have to go get partnerships from people like Chainlink. You have to go get liquidity from someone like Layer Zero. And they know that that is going to be the kind of like limiting factor for you to bootstrap. And for a lot of these projects, they're just going to say, look, actually the viable way for me to do this is to do something like Blast, where I'm going to have some like Ponzi-nomic mechanism where I'm going to get a lot of TVL. And that TVL is allowing me to raise a bunch of capital or start collecting like a premium, a couple bips or whatever off of that capital I have locked, then I'm going to take that capital. I'm going to use the liquidity. I'm going to incentivize the developer ecosystem. And then I'm going to use this liquidity in this developer ecosystem to go raise external capital and to give me negotiating power when I go talk to Layer Zero and Chainlink so that I'm able to get a BD integration with these people at a lower cost because I've already done a bunch of bootstrapping work to get this, right? But what you end up with is a lot of this kind of like magic made up yield because you need to have some mechanism of creating this yield to get this liquidity to allow you to get these BD things. Because you don't have any of this, where the hell are you getting $10 million to give to Chainlink to get an Oracle to bootstrap the fact that you can even have like a lending pool on your chain? So that's a lot of the things. We look at a lot of the kind of newcomers in the space. I think Hyperlane's like a very good example of them just kind of biting the bullet and saying, look, what are we doing on like the bridging? This stuff's not that hard. Like you just go make an escrow contract and you say, well, this is how you build like an escrow mint lock, whatever contract on an EVM. This is how you go do that on a Cosmos chain, right? This is how you go do that on Fuel. All of that can just be open source. You can have a bash script that just says, git clone this repo, put in your kind of like, you know, private key into like this field for your deployment address, right? Run a script and it's going to go deploy the contract there. Running a relayer is just like an out of the box kind of component. Go run it on any cloud. It's a fancy cron job. It's going to go relay packets from like point A to point B. And they can just provide that as like an out of the box thing. There's no need to kind of tie into Layer Zero. And there's difficulty of like, you don't get a liquidity network kind of for free out of that. But the technical thing is kind of taken away from this kind of like gatekept space. And then in the kind of Oracle space, I think we're starting to see a lot of new entrants, right? Most notably, I think I would point out, like, you have like the Chronicle guys, right? It's like a spin out of like MakerDAO or saying like, look, we're gonna get in the business of just saying, we had an Oracle, the fine Oracle, it works well, it works at scale, right? Supporting a lot of the Maker activity. There's no reason we can't just deploy, again, those contracts on any L1. We can go run another instance of like the nodes that actually go read the price feeds from wherever and write that data on chain. And we just can take a differentiated kind of market position than Chainlink, where we say, no, we're going to be in the business of supporting a large number of chains. And we are just going to cut down on like Chainlink's ability to charge these margins because very much a lot of these price feeds are like a good enough thing, right? Like where is Chainlink getting like magical data that like no one else is kind of buying off the market, right? There's not that many centralized exchanges. Most of these people are going to have like an API with a quota that's just going to be costs that you just like pay them. They're open to selling their data for money, right? And so we're starting to see that. And then the last thing in that, you know, kind of Astry is thinking a lot about from a design and, you know, going back to the kind of like last slide in my presentation on the use of kind of, you know, a shared sequencer as this kind of base that provides a derivation function that is the actual rollup state, you know, the way we see this and where I'm kind of pulling a lot of this terminology from the derivation function is out of like the Optimism guys, really, really good docs on like their L2 derivation path. That's how they do bridge transactions, right? They just look at the L1 and they say, there was a deposit transaction on this L1. I'm just going to derive at the top of the block in my like L2 state machine that like bridge transaction. There's no reason we can't also use like an Oracle feed for that, right? You can just say, hey, we posted an Oracle update and that was posted on like the L1 or in our case on the shared sequencer layer. And this rollup or many rollups can all choose to just say, as part of my rollup's derivation function, I'm going to just pull inherently at every single block timing and stack at the top of my block an Oracle update that is shared among the shared sequencer. And now all of the rollups that use the single shared sequencer all get the exact same Oracle feed, and specifically they don't have to go do an integration with like an external partner, right? And fundamentally, again, going back to this kind of like business positioning, right, a shared sequencer is middleware. And if you look in like a B2B SaaS kind of like enterprise case, how middleware works, right, is a middleware is going to be kind of like a reseller of like plugins, or like, you know, whether it's downstream or whether it's parallel, you know, these plugins and ecosystems that like work into the shared sequencer, and then the shared sequencer, the middleware generally, and then you're going to have customers of the middleware, right? And what you're going to get is the more customers you get of the middleware, the easier time as a piece of middleware you're going to have convincing plugins or kind of ecosystems to tie in and use you as a channel sales partner to get to your existing customers. And then the more channel partners and plugins you get, the easier it is for you to get kind of more customers. And this is why you see a lot of people when they talk about shared sequencers, and you know, when I, you know, do VC calls or whatever, and they ask about, you know, us versus Espresso or whatever, right? And they say, you know, this seems like an ecosystem that is a winner take most. And there is like a reality to that, right? Middleware is something that has a flywheel effect in compounding gains to integrations, right? But I think we're just like early enough in the space, but that is generally how we view this, right? Can we provide, you know, bridging is something that is kind of shared among a lot of these chains, right? Can we provide Oracle updates as something that is integrated with the shared sequencer that comes out of the box to these rollups? And again, going to this commoditize the complement, what are all of the things that we can provide as this batteries included experience to a developer who says, well, I want to build a rollup. And maybe I'm going to start with this, you know, OP stack or Arbitrum or Polygon CDK or whatever to develop my like rollup framework, but I can also use this shared sequencer. And now I get decentralized sequencing, and now I get kind of an abstraction around the DA layer. So I have to do that integration myself. And then I also get an Oracle feed out of that for free. And maybe I get some liquidity and bridging out of that as well. Right. And so they're able to bootstrap and benefit from a lot of this kind of flywheel network effect stuff.
Yeah. So first of all, man, you've got a way of like crafting a visual for an answer, which is, it really paints a picture. And I think that the idea behind actually going out and commoditizing the complement, commoditizing and then offering the complement is powerful. And then in the crypto ethos, it's powerful from a whole different angle of like libertarianism, of like rent seeking, of like the reason why we're here. You know, but I'm still not sure you're going to be able to like get over all of those humps all at once. Like, are people going to come to you and you'll be able to provide them a 10x cheaper solution to launch a rollup compared to a RAS provider with that tooling in the next year? Like, is that a reality that you think is actually happening?
Yeah. So I think there's like a big question around like the bootstrapping, right? Like fundamentally, like a shared sequencer, and it's like, why would someone use, you know, X over like Y? And like fundamentally from like a business, a startup kind of like just like process we went about like with Astria, we kind of like eschewed a lot of the kind of more conventional kind of like startup Y Combinator accelerator kind of style mechanism where you say, go build the minimum viable product, get it in front of users, and then iterate on their feedback very rapidly. And I think if you look at like these RAS providers, right, they took kind of like the low hanging fruit and they said, I'm going to go take an open source rollup framework off the shelf. I'm not going to do anything building my own rollup framework. I'm going to go take their bash scripts or whatever the hell, right? And I'm just going to like straight just copy that code, and I'm just going to go deploy that on like GCP or AWS or Azure or like on-prem or whatever, right? And then I'm going to go resell that, and I'm going to charge like a margin on top of that, right? And I'm going to clear that button. And essentially, it's like a classic like DevOps, like platform as a service thing, right? You're making money on the margin of you have a bunch of like DevOps guys on your side, and they are allowing these servers to kind of run with like high uptime, and you resell that at like a premium to like your end users for like a specific use case, right? And like general like cloud, you see people kind of trying to go up market from like infrastructure as a service to platform as a service to like software as a service. It is these more kind of like turnkey things, right? And we took this different approach of saying, we're going to look at this ecosystem kind of more holistically. And I'm going to say, I'm not going to go pick the thing that is like the off the shelf kind of like standard thing and just go redeploy that in like a very like unmote kind of like undifferentiated thing. And that means that we're going to have like a slower time before we get in front of kind of like end users and customers. And one of the big limiting factors of like Astria right now from like an adoption perspective is a shared sequencer is like another L1, right? It's a decentralized network. And the reality of a decentralized network is that there's a somewhat arbitrary distinction between like a testnet and a mainnet, right? Like we saw this again with like layer zero, right? When they made like a bridge between like whatever, like Sapoli or whatever testnet it was, right? And there was like a market. And like the reality is, right, like, oh, that's a testnet, but like now there's like a market to like buy the testnet coins. The testnet coins are like real, right? They have a value because they're just a market. That's just how money works. But from our view, right, like we haven't like labeled like our shared sequencer networks like a mainnet thing, right? We're going through an audit right now, right? Fundamentally, we're building like a novel state machine for the system. And so people can't build on top of the shared sequencer in a mainnet capacity because they have a dependency kind of under them that isn't kind of like mainnet ready by a somewhat kind of arbitrary kind of like, you know, signaling kind of decision. And so we fundamentally are going to be like late to market relative to these people taking something kind of more out of the box, kind of off the shelf. But fundamentally our view is that, you know, we have what we believe to be the correct mid-long-term design. And we were willing to kind of accept the trade-off of saying, no, I'm not going to do the absolute minimum viable thing and get that in front of customers right now. Because to some degree, I think the market is not quite ready for it, right? We're seeing a bunch of L3s, but you know, my view is like, we see a lot of these like L2s, L3s, whatever, they're like OP stack, superchain, whatever. But like to some degree, they're kind of so undifferentiated, they're like a marketing exercise, right? You're like, what is the difference between like Mode Network and like Optimism Mainnet? You're like, well, Optimism Mainnet is red and Mode Network is yellow, right? And then there's like some like marketing things to it. And there's like some incentive structures around like whatever the coins out of like Mode Network and like their structure thing. But like fundamentally code wise, like the Mode Network guys haven't made like significant changes to like the upstream OP mainnet. And from an end user perspective, they're kind of like, why the hell would I choose to use the yellow network instead of like the blue network instead of the red network, right? And so our view was saying, we see that. I don't think there's a lot of like differentiation necessarily in that space. We think we can provide, you know, some of the functionality of what people want out of these rollups and these rollup of the service, which is this job of sequencing. It's this abstraction of running the kind of infrastructure. We can provide that in a way that is abstract from the specific state machine implementation, which in this case might be, again, this OP stack, this Arbitrum Orbit, this Polygon CDK. And so, yeah, we're going to be a little bit later on getting the immediate things right now that are ready to go and getting those mainnet, but we are able to carry on a lot of our kind of investment from like an institutional technical knowledge because we have a large team. You know, my team is like 17 people now, right? And of those people, 14 of those are like protocol engineers, right? And then it's like myself as a CEO and like Ishida is our great head of strategy and like Christian is our COO, right? But like 14 engineers, most of them do a protocol engineering, right? We have a lot of institutional knowledge and momentum on how to do protocol engineering. We've invested that. And therefore, based on how the future goes, we're not completely dependent on these rollup frameworks from saying, oh, well, Optimism and Arbitrum and Polygon think this is the way that a rollup should be built in 3 months and 6 months and 12 months. If you're a person who just has purely DevOps experience and is in the business of deploying code that other people write, if they choose to go a direction that is not desirable for you from a business ecosystem or from an ideological position, you don't have the institutional protocol engineering knowledge to build your own kind of rollup framework on top of that because you didn't make that investment. You may have gotten to market sooner, but you just have like a differentiated kind of amount and quality of institutional knowledge for being able to kind of move in the market. And so that's like a fundamental trade-off. To your point on the kind of like specific, you know, are we going to be 10x cheaper? I don't think we are. And I gave a talk at, you know, the Espresso guys kind of like beyond the base layer event at like East Denver that kind of touched on this in like a little short, like 2 minute rant. Like fundamentally we do as like an industry have to kind of decide like, what are the thing we're doing here, right? Are we doing centralized things? Or are we doing decentralized things? Fundamentally, decentralization at an absolute technical level is going to be more expensive because like, how do you decentralize a thing? You have more people run more copies of the same thing, right? And one of the reasons I'm very excited about Celestia is like, it changes a little bit of the ratio there, right? You can have one person run some fractional percentage of the overall kind of like data that makes up the ledger instead of every single person has to, you know, store 100% of the ledger and therefore you have like N copies, right? But at the end of the day, the difference is like you run a centralized service, you might have like three copies of the data. You might have one in like US West, you might have one in Europe, you might have one in like Asia or whatever, right? If you're running like a blockchain, like how the hell many copies of like the Ethereum ledger are there? I don't know. There's like 500,000 like validators and that's like an arbitrary binning mechanism. But like you might have like 10,000 or 100,000 or whatever like full nodes of like the ledger state, right? That costs money. Like someone's paying money to run computers. And so similar on the sequencing thing, right? If you run one centralized sequencer, that's going to be cheaper just to accept the fact that like, okay, it's like a centralized thing. Do you want to be in the business of doing centralized things, right? You know, are you okay with like having the escape hatch? You know, I think a lot of people talk about, oh, the escape hatch and your funds are safe. And I agree on that. But fundamentally, if you're like using Optimism and like the government is like, hey, the Optimism sequencer is going to be like turned off and like, good luck getting that back on, you know, maybe that's off for like 2 weeks. Like how long before people are just like, maybe the only transactions I'm submitting to the L1 through like the escape hatch are like not transactions that continue trading using Optimism. Maybe I'm just going to withdraw all my funds off of like Optimism because fundamentally I came here for the sequencer. And I don't want to like FUD the like regulatory risk like excessively.
No.
But there is this design question of, if you're doing a decentralized thing, it's going to be more expensive. And are you okay with that? And what kind of fundamental like design space does that allow you to work in? Our view is we need to kind of commoditize everything else such that the all-in cost, maybe it's not absolutely cheaper, but it's providing a high quality user experience that is worth people paying this cost of it being decentralized.
If, and Josh, if what's going to happen is those RAS guys are going to end up offering Astria as a shared sequencer on their RAS. And then people are going to be like, well, fuck, why don't I just go use Astria?
Yeah, and or they're going to build their own shared sequencer, right? Like the least surprising thing in the world. Like I would be extremely surprised if like the Conduit guys were not building their own shared sequencer right now. Like that would be like very, very surprising to me, right? I just assume that these people are going to kind of like, you know, because I know a lot of that's like showing my own bags thing, right? But like to some degree, based on my time spent in this industry, I think I have like a relatively good record of building things that I then see a large number of kind of competitors come up into the space and build a similar thing. And there's a fundamental reality, I think, Patrick Collins over, you know, the founder of like Stripe, you know, had a really good podcast on like Dwarkesh's podcast recently. And, you know, they talked about like moats and how do you have a moat? And there is just a moat in competency. There's just a, like, a, how do I have a moat? You're like, I'm going to hire better people and I'm going to execute better. And if I continually do that, I'm never going to give someone else an opportunity to catch up to me. And everyone's like, oh, that's not comfy. That doesn't let you quiet quit. That doesn't let you retire early. And you're like, no, but you're doing a competitive business, right? You can just hire better people and compete. And, you know, if people and competitors come in, like, that's a good thing, right? You know, to the point on commoditize the compliment, right? There's this very, like, Bezos term, right? It's like, you know, your margin is my opportunity, right? Fundamentally, if you just say, I can run a tighter ship, I can run like a more efficient organization, I can just have a 1% smaller profit margin than you, and I'm still able to run that efficiently enough that I am still profitable enough, and maybe you're not profitable at that margin anymore, right? And I think one of the things in crypto that I'm hoping we see in the kind of roll-up space and going forward in this modular space, kind of enabled by a lot of this flexibility and different kind of economic specialization, different layers in the stack, is more competitive dynamics where, you know, one of the biggest kind of problems I think in crypto is like these networks like don't go away, right? There are networks no one uses that just sit there and just like have like a captive like $20 billion in them, right? I think I actually want to see more competitive dynamics where, yeah, three people are building the same thing and maybe two of those people go away or maybe one of those people goes away, right? But the people who survive will be more competitive in the space. They'll have a better quality organization. They'll create better quality code, better quality products, and the end user experience will be better for that. And we won't have a lot of these kind of like gatekeepers that don't have like sufficient economic kind of competitive pressure to improve their product and aren't allowed to just kind of like sit on their haunches.
How do you prevent a compliment from coming in and commoditizing Astria?
I don't think you do really, like to some degree, right? Like that's just like a competitive dynamic, right? You can see it from like a marketing perspective, again, going back to like the Apple and whatever. I think we'll see this with, you know, again, like the Arbitrum people, right? They tried to do this by way of like making their code like BSL, right? They said, okay, you guys just can't copy and paste unless you essentially pay a tax. And that structurally looks a lot like what you see with like Apple and like the App Store and like the 30% rent they charge on like, you know, Apple Music for Spotify, right? You know, Apple is okay to have Spotify running on the iPhone because they know that Apple Music definitionally will always have a 30% margin advantage on Spotify because Spotify has to pay rent to them. Arbitrum doesn't have to worry about other Orbit chains competing with Arbitrum One because those Orbit chains are always gonna have to pay a 10% tax to like the Arbitrum DAO. So they'll always have just like a mechanical advantage. If we look in the Optimism space, right? You know, a lot of what they're trying to do is they're saying, we're gonna be like very open and kind of like, you know, permissionless and like MIT licensed, and a lot of props to them for that and kind of like giving their software away for free in that capacity. To some degree, there's like a legitimacy to it, right? Why would someone wanna use like a roll-up network that is like the like illegitimate kind of like child of this? I think that's what we've seen a lot with like Metis and Boba, right? When they like forked like Optimism V1, there's always this question of like, why would you use the one that's the fork of the mainstream one? The mainstream one's still going. Why do you want to use like the illegitimate fork of that? And we see this in crypto networks generally, right? Forking is fundamentally like a social consensus thing. And so from an, like an Astria perspective, like fundamentally, again, to like the moat via competency. Our job is just to provide a better quality user experience and product and developer experience, developer tooling, such that if someone else chooses to say, oh, we're going to go git clone our repos, our repos are MIT. Everyone can like git clone our freaking repo and go run like a separate, like ask your shared sequencer network if they want, right? And we just have to believe that we ourselves are a sufficiently competent organization that those people will do a worse job utilizing our code than we will be able to do utilizing our code. And to some degree, like if we can't, if someone else can go take our open source code and like make a better product, then like maybe we shouldn't be in this business at all, because like we were able to create something and we were unable to kind of like, you know, utilize it to its maximum ability. Maybe it's better if you get kind of like beat out of the market by like your code was open source and you just weren't able to capitalize on it.
Great example of this is Craig Wright forking Bitcoin and trying to do his thing with Bitcoin SV while Bitcoin the OG is still running. Look how that worked out. Josh, this was a banger, man. I think we might call this one the competency tax.
Yeah, sounds good to me. Yeah. I mean, if you guys have any other questions, you know, happy to chat. I have a little bit of time I can go over, but really, really appreciate you guys having me on the podcast.
Yeah, I'll shoot for one more, which is, are you worried as, like, we had a really interesting conversation where proof of work, Bitcoin is like this proof of energy, proof of electricity. It's like this hard-backed money, if you will, and proof of stake's almost like a meme. It's like if everybody believes that Ethereum has value, everyone's willing to stake to believe in this method, then there's a lot of social consensus. So Ethereum itself is almost like it's a community, it's a social consensus more than like a monetary consensus. Are you worried at all about how you're going to bootstrap the social consensus of Astria as an extra L1 for rollups? Like, how are you going to go and convince, you know, all like Arbitrum Optimism or even like smaller ones that, hey guys, like we are a viable option and like we have this X, Y, and Z to prove it. And like, here's who believes in us. Like how are you going to cross the chasm of like the social consensus?
Yeah. I mean, I think like fundamentally, right. Like my view is that like the biggest mistake Ethereum ever made was like moving to like proof of stake, right? Like fundamentally giving up proof of work. Like they could have very easily had like a dominant position in being the only smart contract chain that was ever proof of work. It's going to be very hard to bootstrap one of these. Fundamentally, it was to some degree just like the Ethereum people being like a little bit too leftist on like the environmental front and just not having sufficient confidence that like their coin was like sufficiently valuable to justify like some energy expenditure on Earth. And yeah, it's just like, it's don't have enough self-confidence in like the project as a whole. But to like the proof of stake kind of like, you know, like mimetic aspect, I think to some degree, the fact that it's all kind of like mimetic and fake and just like social consensus thing, right? Like makes the bootstrapping problem like very easy, right? It's very difficult to kind of like justify people to like get over this hurdle of like running a bunch of like, you know, proof of work miners and like making ASICs and like taping stuff out and like doing all this work to kind of bootstrap that. If it's proof of stake, there's just kind of like, like people have money and they will put that money where like they get yield and like the proof of stake thing like generates some like yield. And so people just kind of go there. And from like an economic legitimacy or an economic security or whatever, there's like various like forms of like psyops and like how you can just like make the number higher, right? You know, like the reality is like Base put like a contract on chain and they didn't even seem to have hired engineers yet. And people put like $500 million in the box on chain. Like the bar to have like these idiots like put money in like a box seems to be like the floor basically. It's like, you have some good tweets and you're backed by Paradigm. And then on like the technical mechanism of like, you know, what's an actual like attack vector on one of these proof of stake chains? Like one, we've just like never seen it actually happen. Like the East Classic people, you know, Yaz, you know, now over at like Celestia has like dealt with like a lot of the forks when like East Classic and that fork happened and dealing with like the real-time forks and how to like kind of reach social consensus again on that. But in like a proof of stake network, we just haven't seen any of like these big divergences because again, like a lot of these chains are all going to be kind of like varying levels of VC chains. They're going to have like relatively low float when they launch, you know, and the float's going to be owned in like, you know, staking contracts, you know, do you stake before like things are unlocked? Maybe it's like, you know, technically impossible in that like, you know, 2/3 of the stake weight is like staked and can't even be transferred via the state machine rules of the chain. So like good luck attacking that. And even then after, it's like, how many centralized exchanges are there for the volume of these, right? The top five exchanges by volume are probably like, you know, some like 80%+ for basically every single coin out there. Like these people are generally good actors. They don't benefit if these chains get like maliciously taken over. Like they will find the right person to talk to if they're like, hey, someone seems to be trying to buy like a relevant double digit percentage of like your overall network. You know, I just don't think we have, you know, people who are like Carl Icahn level, like activist investor trying to like maliciously attack like a proof of stake chain. And even then you just kind of hard fork and you go to social consensus and you just say like, like the majority of like the crypto, Twitter, Discord, whatever users like not like whatever billionaire like maliciously tried to acquire like 2/3 of the stake by buying all the liquidity on like OKX and Binance, then like, sure, we'll just like hard fork. It's like, you know, 10 lines of code and we just like zero out their account balance and like, you know, good luck, have fun, like see if the centralized exchanges will still take your coins. I'm not that stressed. Like, obviously I worry about it, right? Because fundamentally it's like necessary to the network and the bootstrapping, but I just think it's like a little bit overblown. Or you can do something, you know, like we've seen a bunch of other projects that are like, I'm just gonna like, I gotta go get like the social consensus that is Ethereum. And that just means that I have to get, you know, like the Ethereum foundation, like priestly kind of cast to like accept that like I am shilling their bag sufficiently. So fine, I'm going to go have like an AVS component of this such that I have like some eigenlayer restaked ETH. And that just like pumps up my economic security numbers by like $500 million. Like there's a lot of mechanisms here. But in general, it's not something that like stresses me out too much because we just haven't seen one of these attacks happen. And the bar to get to like a sufficiently high amount of capital, it's like a non-trivial thing that doesn't cost like millions of dollars of the capital being staked and would like persist beyond like a social consensus discussion. I just don't think that's like a reality that we live in right now.
Josh, I think this has been my favorite episode of Modular March. Thank you so much for making us laugh. I think it's a Friday thing. I mean, not taking any credit from you, but Fridays, the vibes are up. We just had a great morning. And I mean, this has been extremely, extremely insightful from several perspectives in terms of business logic, on-chain incentive design, game theory. Rob's got a math and philosophy degree, so I know his brain is very stimulated right now as well. So thank you for coming on and sharing some insights.
Yeah, really appreciate you guys having me.
Cheers.